Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When you meet someone online, can you trust they are who they say they are?
I keep thinking so much about you.
She's so stunning.
It's all well planned.
Love, Janessa is the true crime podcast from the BBC World Service and CBC Podcasts, exploring the world of online romance scams. And it's available now. Find it wherever you found this podcast.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and at 13 hours GMT on the 4th of September, these are our main stories. The Kenyan president has opened Africa's first climate summit, urging fellow leaders to focus on solutions rather than who's to blame for global warming. Zimbabwe's president Emmerson Mnangagwa is being sworn in despite concerns about the credibility of last month's election. And Ukraine has a new defence minister. We'll get more from Kyiv on the man charged with leading the war effort. Also in this podcast.
The whales do a huge amount for us when it comes to keeping our oceans healthy. It's bad for our reputation. It's bad for animal welfare.
There's anger as Iceland resumes commercial whaling. Now, climate change is seriously threatening to Africa, with the continent viewed as the most vulnerable from the impact of environmental changes. In light of that, leaders from across Africa are gathering in Kenya for a summit aimed at promoting renewable energy and a shared vision for sustainable development. The host, Kenya's President William Ruto, said they should seek solutions, though, rather than catalogue grievances and problems. Our chief Africa correspondent, Anne Soy, is at the conference. I asked her what we can expect from the African leaders meeting today.
To build consensus and to speak with one voice when they go to the COP28, the UN climate summit that's upcoming in Dubai in November. And so they hope to discuss ideas that they will be taking to the table. The host president, Ruto, has been very keen for Africa to be proactive. And he said this morning during the opening meeting that they are not here to list grievances. They are here to find solutions.
You have not just stepped into a conference hall. You have entered the future, a future ripe with potential, driven by global partnerships committed to African prosperity, inclusive growth, and a livable planet for all of us.
Now, as ever with these conferences, it needs the most important people there. So are the most important influential people there?
To a large extent, yes. I would have expected to see more African heads of state. We're having just about half of them here. We have experts, we have other delegates, including activists. So we're expecting very vibrant discussions over the next 3 days. They hope there will be consensus. They hope they will have a Nairobi declaration. However, there are issues, there are contentious. For instance, carbon trading, that's a very contentious issue here. And also activists just saying that some of the leaders are not putting everything they can to fight climate change.
So what is it they actually want to get to by the end of 3 days' time? Is this going to be clear declarations they can take to Dubai later in the year?
Yes, absolutely. So they hope to come up with a Nairobi declaration. And already the Kenyan president, the host of this meeting, has sort of set out the agenda, saying that they want to look at what Africa can offer, what solutions they can take to the table. They're looking at the minerals that they have on the continent, which are used to drive the move towards green energy, electric vehicles. He drove himself yesterday and today to the conference in an electric car to make the point. They're also looking at financing solutions and discussing some of them. He has urged countries that made commitments during previous climate summits to finance climate solutions but haven't come through. He has urged them to make good their commitment, to fulfill their commitments.
And Soy in Nairobi. Ukraine says Russia has carried out a huge drone attack against the port city of Izmail on the River Danube, from where agricultural products were being exported. Officials say warehouses and other infrastructure have been damaged. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams.
Russia has been hitting Ukraine's port facilities along the Danube River for over a month, trying to prevent Ukraine from using the river to export its grain. with last year's UN-brokered Black Sea Grain Initiative on hold and being discussed today at talks between Vladimir Putin and Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Moscow doesn't want Ukraine to develop viable alternative routes. In the latest air attacks overnight, Ukraine says two Russian kamikaze drones fell on the other side of the Danube River, inside Romanian territory. Romania seems to be denying this. The Defense Ministry in Bucharest condemned the latest Russian attacks, but said they did not pose any direct military threat against Romania.
Paul Adams reporting. Next, let's go to the occupied West Bank city of Jenin, where Israeli security forces have targeted a refugee camp, wounding several Palestinians. In July, a similar raid in Jenin killed at least 17 Palestinians, and it led to widespread unrest. Our Middle East correspondent Tom Bateman told me the latest from Jerusalem.
We know the Palestinian Ministry of Health has said at least four people sent to hospitals in Jenin. Most of those look like minor injuries. But it seems that two of the militants that were involved in a gun battle with the Israelis may well have more significant injuries. We saw pictures of at least one of those being stretchered away by Israeli troops into a helicopter after he had been detained by the Israelis. In terms of what happened on the ground, I mean, this started, as so many of these raids have over the last year or so, as an entrance into the city by undercover Israeli special forces. Sometimes they go in things like dairy trucks. This time it seems they went in Palestinian vehicles with Palestinian license plates, but at some point their cover was blown. They were then being shot at by Palestinian militants from the Al-Qassam Brigades. That's the armed wing of Hamas, the Palestinian militant group, from the building it seems the Israelis were targeting. And significantly, some of those injuries have come from, according to unconfirmed Israeli reports, an explosive drone, or a so-called suicide drone, that it seems was used above or near to a vehicle, causing injuries among those militants. The militant group itself has said that it claimed that it shot down the drone, and pictures of part of a drone have emerged online since then. So I think what you're seeing is this sort of ever-increasing sense of militarization, the use of, you know, increasingly heavy lethal force once again in Jenin as the West Bank continues this slide into further bloodshed.
It's the simplest of questions, but maybe the most important. Just remind us, why does Israel feel the need to launch these raids, incursions like this?
Well, Jenin is one of two cities in the north of the West Bank alongside Nablus that over the last 18 months to 2 years have seen the official Palestinian Authority. Now, that's the internationally backed organization that has limited governance powers in the West Bank. It's seen the PA has lost control of some of these cities to armed militants. Now, many Palestinians see them as a heartland of resistance to Israel's occupation. The Israelis call them hubs of terrorism. And as we see increasing attacks against Israelis, they've been launching increasingly lethal military raids into these cities. They say to apprehend gunmen. In many cases, we're seeing gun battles and militants dying and civilians as well.
Tom Bateman speaking to me from Jerusalem. Now, in Zimbabwe, the president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, has delivered his inauguration speech after he was sworn in for a second term.
I stand before you, my fellow Zimbabweans and countrymen and women, at this historic moment of our nation as the president of all Zimbabweans, regardless of tribe, religion, colour, creed or political persuasion.
There have been concerns, though, over the credibility of last month's election, with analysts in the region claiming the poll failed to meet democratic standards. They also claim it fell short of Zimbabwe's own constitution. Well, our Zimbabwe correspondent, Shinge Onyoka, has been following the ceremony and told me more.
Well, what has happened so far is that President Emmerson Mnangagwa has been sworn in. He was sworn in by the Chief Justice in front of tens of thousands of supporters, and there was a celebration with some of his favorite music after that. But I think it's quite interesting to note who was there. Regional leaders, despite the fact that the election observer missions from those various countries said that this election fell short of democratic standards, notably President Cyril Ramaphosa is there, as well as the Mozambican President Filipe Nyusi and former First Lady Grace Mugabe. And so it really seems as if President Mnangagwa is moving on, despite the fact that this election win was disputed. The opposition, we understand, was invited to attend and they declined. They still maintain that they want fresh elections. But given that this inauguration has gone ahead, he's been sworn in, it's just not clear what other options they have now.
So you see this definitely as a vote of confidence from, you know, South Africa and others in Emmerson Mnangagwa's leadership?
Not so much a vote of confidence, but just support for his government. It would have been very difficult given the proximity of these countries and historical relationships between them for these leaders not to attend. What is not clear is what happens now, whether these leaders are going to pressure Emmerson Mnangagwa to implement some of the reforms that were spelt out by the election observer missions, or reforms around some of the laws, and as well as whether he's going to, or they're going to try and press upon him to bring about some kind of unity to unite this very divided country.
Our Zimbabwe correspondent, Shinge Inoka. After a two-month ban on whaling, Icelandic boats have been given authorization to hunt fin whales again, but with new guidelines aimed at killing them as quickly as possible to reduce suffering. The temporary suspension came in after it was found that the culling of the whales was taking too long, and it was in breach of animal welfare laws. The controversial move has angered conservation activists and caused a political storm on the island nation, one of three countries, alongside Norway and Japan, where whaling is still legal. Adrian Murray sent this report from Iceland.
In Reykjavik harbour, an old whaling boat manoeuvres into dock. It's been readying to head out to sea and go hunting. Earlier this summer, the practice was suspended over animal welfare concerns. But within Iceland, the sudden stoppage caused a political row. And now the government has let whaling restart. The Minister of Food, Agriculture and Fisheries, Svandís Svavardóttir, said she's done so reluctantly.
This discussion is far from over. I think it is important that it continues in the society as a whole and in politics. We are the last nation in the world that allows hunting of whales in this way.
Animal rights activists and environmentalists have condemned the move. In Reykjavik, dozens gathered to protest, including Icelandic actress and activist Hera Hilmar.
It's a very sad day. I'm not really proud to be an Icelandic citizen today. But at the same time, I am, because the majority of us really doesn't want this and is actually fighting this. We don't eat the meat. The whales do a huge amount for us when it comes to keeping our oceans healthy. It's bad for our reputation. It's bad for animal welfare.
An injunction has been filed in a bid to block further whaling. And some Hollywood filmmakers and actors like Leonardo DiCaprio and James Cameron have called for it to stop. Fin whales are listed as vulnerable globally, but stocks in Iceland are reportedly stable. Only one whaling station still hunts them and exports the meat to Japan. The firm Valor says it won't hang up its harpoons anytime soon. Christian Lofsen is the owner.
If you have a healthy stock of fish or whales, you utilize them. If the stocks are not healthy, you don't utilize them. It's as simple as that. And we have about the stock estimate for fin whales around Iceland is about 40,000 animals. The quota is about 160 something. So this is a resource utilization.
Critics would argue that the way whales have been hunted hasn't been humanely done.
Yeah, what is the norm for humanely done? I don't know. What is humane? I mean, this is kind of a ridiculous word to apply to animals, in my opinion.
Just two other countries, Norway and Japan, still allow commercial whaling. In 1986, there was a global moratorium due to dwindling whale stocks. Iceland halted the practice shortly after, but restarted again in 2006.
Around the world, commercial whaling has mostly been consigned to the history books. But here in Iceland, it remains a highly emotive issue.
In recent years, the views of Icelanders have undergone a sea change. And the latest poll shows 42% are against it, while 29% remain in favour.
It's totally against, like, animal rights. It's totally against biodiversity of the sea, of the ocean. Allowing whaling in Iceland is like you know, it's not, the Icelandic nation is not gaining anything from it. It's just this one company, and where is it going? For what? And why?
In general, I think most Icelanders are against it. But there is, you know, other parts of Iceland that sort of see it. If it's done in a sustainable manner, it provides occupation for a local population in a small town.
It was handled very poorly. The Minister of the Sea Affairs did a very poor job, in my opinion. It was a very short notice that he said no, and now he has to turn around and allow it.
In downtown Reykjavik, chef Stefan Ulfesson runs fish restaurant Thurir Fraka.
We make whale sashimi, and it's really influenced by the Japanese. And we have whale pepper steak.
He says whale dishes will stay on the menu.
We have local customers, and then a lot of tourists that would like to, very curious about to tasting it.
Hey, here we go, we have a pinky whale now. And
But while whaling has been done for centuries, one in four visitors now go whale watching. And it's a chance to see these creatures in the wild. It's becoming one of Iceland's biggest draws.
Adrian Murray, reporting from Iceland. Still to come.
Sometimes I feel so hungry. And when I look at other children, they don't suffer. Sometimes I think that I have no reason to live.
Children are being forced into sexual exploitation because of the global rise in the cost of living, according to the UN.
Unexpected Elements is the podcast that sifts through the week's news to unearth surprising nuggets of science.
I really wanted to look at an animal that, as far as we can tell at least, doesn't seem to age.
Okay, you have my attention, tell me more.
And uncover the unexpected connections between them.
I think now's a good time to talk about worms.
Really? Worms?
Absolutely.
Unexpected Elements from the BBC World Service.
Amazing stuff.
Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello again. This is the Global News Podcast. Children are being forced into sexual exploitation and other forms of harmful work because of the global rise in the cost of living. That's according to the United Nations. The claims come from its agency, the International Labour Organization, and they echo similar concerns that have been raised by NGO workers in Kenya about the measures that some families there take to survive. From Mombasa, our correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher has more. And just to warn you, you may find some of the details that follow distressing.
Mombasa is a port city, of course, and I'm down by the entrance to the sea. I've just seen a lot of people streaming onto a ferry. This has long been a well-known hub for child sex tourism. But COVID and the increasingly harsh cost of living have helped to push the sex trade online and even further underground. And that's been drawing even more children into the industry.
In a wooden shack with the sun shining through gaps in the roof, I meet a mother who's had to make a painful decision. She takes in washing a few times a week to support her three children and doesn't want us to use her name. The money for school fees quickly runs out, she says. There's barely enough for food. So her 14-year-old daughter has to find work. She started selling her body.
As a parent, it's not easy to tell a child to do something like that. I would like her to go to school like other children. But because I don't have any means, she's forced to do that job. My heart is broken, and I don't want it to continue.
She's not the only one. We've spoken with a woman who runs a brothel. She told us she's been getting more and more young girls. At this shelter, there is a rare moment of joy. The children are celebrating a birthday party. They're here because they were abused, abandoned, trafficked, or forced into the sex trade. Grace Odemba runs this center and two others. They're struggling to meet the growing needs.
Now everyone wants to survive. They've been giving away their children for exchange of money.
And has it always been that way, or is it more so now?
Now it's more so because there is no money, there is no job.
It's the poorest Kenyans who've been hit the hardest. And there are those who are ready to take advantage of this.
On your phone, your laptop, your
memory devices.
This undercover police unit is cracking down on the dark trade in child sex. Here, raiding the home of a man who's posted offensive material on the internet. Officers track down suspects using cyber tips from a database in the United States. Then they search phones and computer drives for explicit material about children. It's exhausting, traumatic work, up against a business that thrives in Mombasa.
You find that there are poor families following the whites for support.
Sex tourism?
Yes.
Mutisia Mweni is in charge of the unit. She says there's no data on whether the recent cost of living crisis has driven more children into the sex trade, but her team has begun monitoring it.
You would say that unemployment, there are so many children that are dropping off out of school, and then you find that they're getting to this, especially in the coastal region.
One girl who hasn't escaped the streets told me about the despair that shapes her young life. We're using her words, but not her voice.
I am afraid because I know that when you're sleeping with a man, you can get HIV or become pregnant. Sometimes I feel so hungry. And when I look at other children, they don't suffer. Sometimes I think that I have no reason to live.
She's trapped by an economy of depravity that feeds on desperation.
Barbara Plett-Usher reporting from the port city of Mombasa. Now, thousands of teachers across South Korea have walked out because of mounting anger over pressure from parents, which they say is leading, in the most extreme instances, to teachers taking their own lives. The death of a young teacher who died by suicide and was found in a school cupboard in July prompted weekly vigils and demonstrations. Teachers have stayed away from work en masse today and headed to rallies instead. Our correspondent Jean McKenzie was at one of them and she told me more.
I'm now at the heart of this protest where thousands of teachers have turned up today. They're all dressed in black. And this is because not only are they protesting because they want this better protection at work, but they're also here to commemorate this teacher who died now 49 days ago. This is a kind of moment to mark in Buddhism where you mark the 49th day after somebody's death. So that's why they're all dressed in black. These protests have been huge now for about 6 weeks. And one at the weekend on Saturday gathered 100,000 people, which was rather extraordinary. It's the largest one we've seen. Today's is smaller because it's a school day, but ever since, you know, teachers have turned up here and they are striking as well. So a lot of them have managed to get off school to be here.
I mean, it's hard to get into a brief answer, but just give us an idea of what life is like and the pressures that are faced by teachers in South Korea.
So really the death of this one teacher opened this Pandora's box here. You know, suddenly you had teachers from all over the country just coming forward and sharing these stories of how they were being harassed by what they would say is overbearing parents who are just so fixated on their children's success. So they're getting, they say, these incessant complaints from parents all hours of the day on their personal mobile phones, late at night, at weekends. And it's just giving them no space to actually teach. But look, sometimes these complaints are really serious. Teachers are saying that, you know, they're being accused of child abuse if they try to restrain violent children in the classroom. They can be accused of emotional abuse if they tell children off or they ask them to leave the classroom because they're being disruptive. And this taps into just this wider societal issue here, which is South Korea is this hyper-competitive society. And, you know, so much here hinges on an academic success. And so parents feel this huge pressure that their children just have to do well at school. And, of course, that pressure is put onto the children and it's being put onto the teachers, we're learning.
And just quickly, I mean, there's a culture there that clearly is not going to change overnight. But what's the government doing? How has it responded to try and reassure teachers?
The government is listening and it is saying to teachers, we are hearing your cries. You know, it has even accepted that its classrooms are broken, which is a pretty big step for the government here. And it's issued this new guidance from teachers, which came into force a couple of days ago, which should in theory give them a bit more control to be able to discipline kids. But the teachers here are saying that they want a much more kind of systemic reform. They particularly want the government to look at this Child Welfare Act, which they think the parents are exploiting. And this is the act that means if you are accused of child abuse, you can be immediately removed from your jobs. But there are plenty of people here who say that it isn't just classrooms that are broken. It is South Korea's entire approach to education that needs to be looked at and reformed.
Jean McKenzie in Seoul. Leaders of the world's most powerful economic nations are gathering in Delhi at the weekend. But we now know one very important person won't be there. China's Xi Jinping is opting out. The G20 summit is supposed to be about tackling global economic challenges. But China's president, currently in charge of the world's troubled number two economy, isn't going. Our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow, is following developments.
We've just got a statement from the Chinese Foreign Ministry essentially confirming what we'd heard through rumours for the last few days, that Li Qiang, the Premier of China, will be going in his place. We can only speculate why Xi Jinping won't be going. One of the reasons could be a major one. It could be that China has decided to pivot away from the G20, a group of many disparate countries with different political ideals underpinning them. And China could be moving towards groupings which it can control, which it feels more in tune with. So, for example, the BRICS group of nations, that's just had a summit in South Africa, which Xi Jinping did attend to. It could also be that Xi Jinping doesn't want to go to India, where the G20 summit is being held. India and China over recent years have had strained relations, clashes along their border. Xi Jinping might not want to go to New Delhi. So all kinds of reasons, but we're not entirely sure why, because the Chinese Foreign Ministry hasn't told us.
No, opaque as ever in Beijing. What about global diplomacy and the prospect, which has been much talk about, of Joe Biden and Xi Jinping sitting down on the periphery of India? That clearly isn't going to happen now. I mean, that's disappointing for the Americans, isn't it?
It's disappointing and it's significant. These are the two biggest countries in the world. Their leaders have only met once before since President Biden took office, and that was interestingly at the last G20 summit meeting in Bali. So President Biden was hoping that he perhaps could sit down with Xi Jinping at this event. He's already expressed his disappointment at not being able to do that. So that was a potential major development at this G20. It's also a loss for the summit as well, I think, because, as you indicated there, China is completely, at the moment, going through very difficult economic difficulties. It's the second biggest economy in the world. And for it not to be there really hampers the G20's ability to deal with those major economic problems facing the world at the moment.
Michael Bristow reporting. And just for the record, Xi Jinping won't be going, but China's Premier Li Qiang, number two in the pecking order, will be there in his place. OK, let's end on dogs. Yes, real dogs, because some have taken part in a performance at a classical music concert in Denmark. Now, it may sound barking, but organisers insist it was what the writer would have wanted. I'm going to stop there and let David Lewis explain.
It may sound like a Wolfgang, but actually, it's a Mozart. The Hunting Symphony was written by Leopold Mozart, Amadeus's father, and is opening the Haydn Classical Music Festival near Copenhagen. The conductor says he's fulfilling the composer's dream. Mozart Sr. said that six bars, not barks, should be accompanied by baying hounds. So how did organisers find the musical maestro Mutz? Well, dozens of dogs were invited to audition back in the spring. Pets performed for a jury, including the festival director and an animal trainer. The chief executive officer of the Danish Chamber Orchestra, Andreas Veto, was also there. He explained how the show would work.
The symphony is in three movements, and in the last movements we will hear the hunt to begin, and we will have shootings, and then the dogs will start to bark around the scenes, and we will have three dogs on his signal that will bark around the orchestra.
Auditionees needed to show the right temperament for the part, howl on command but stay silent for the rest of the performance. Pooches were whittled down to just three: Cookie, Sophus and Seeker. After 3 months of training, they were ready. Cookie's owner, Hella Lauvering, said there were no pre-show nerves.
If I had to be there by myself, I think I would be nervous. But, you know, all the attention is at her. And, you know, she's the star. She's the star. I'm just behind her, you know, with all the treats.
The canine's cameo would have an extra benefit. The trio of dogs taking part would also get four free concert tickets for their humans.
David Lewis on Denmark and dogs. Let's just leave that one there now. Well, that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Dan Ehrlich and the producer was Beth Timmons. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Thanks for listening. Until next time, goodbye.